You had mentioned, though, that somewhere along the line, 3M started putting money in.
Yeah.
Or that much later.
Well, that happened after I left. Now, 3M and I always had a problem with each other, and I think that's one of the reasons why they never gave us money earlier, okay? Because 3M treated our department very badly. 3M was the most surprised operation in the world when the first departmental ratings came up, and we were so high on it. They couldn't understand that at all, okay, because they never liked this whole theoretical approach, because 3M is an entrepreneurial kind of operation that for a long time did Edisonian research, okay? And they just had no understanding at all of what the theoretical aspect of it was. So 3M was not very friendly toward us. Okay. Now, after I left, people like Davis and Scriven and Polymer people there, 3M suddenly discovered that these people were doing things they really should be interested in. Okay, so now they have a very friendly relationship, and some of that is because I'm gone. Some of that's because I'm gone. But now they have a very nice relationship, as a matter of fact, and I think 3M has even given them some funds for a chair, you know, within the department, an endowed chair.
Your students are responsible for spreading the word, as it were,
right, indeed,
throughout the engineering
right.
profession. How did your early students fare when they went? Did most of them go into academic positions, or did they go into?
Well, let's see. Let's put it this way. I would say the very earliest ones, say in the early 50s, maybe even up to 1960 or so, most of those people went into industry, okay? Then I would say, starting with the group in the early 60s, a substantial number went into academic jobs. Academic jobs, you know, there's Luss, who is here, Roger Schmitz, who is the vice president on Notre Dame, Curtis Dills, his name, is vice president of the University of Washington. Leon Lapidus was department chairman at Princeton. Andy Akrivos is the Einstein professor at City University. So all of, you know, lots of those chaps and those kind of jobs. But on the other hand, Lee Raymond is now president of Exxon. Okay, he was my student. Ken Valentis is a vice president at Pillsbury. Hart, Schmiel, Hagen are department managers over here at Shell. You know, so that. I would say that there was a fairly even split, really, although lots of people think they all went into academic jobs, but that's not true. There's a fairly even split. But I think if you look at the general percentage of chemical engineering faculty who were at the University of Minnesota. It's larger than from any other university in the United States right now, because our Rutherford Harris had 30 PhDs, for example. Scrivens had 35 or 40. Chap who's a department chairman of MIT now is one of Scrivens' student fellows at the University of Washington is one of Scrivens' students. George Cavalis is at Caltech. Mort N is at Berkeley. Bob Schechter is up here at UT. You know, they're just all over the place. So, in general, the University of Minnesota PhDs, I'm not just talking about the ones I had, but the others, are really very well represented out there. And it's still going on. Northwestern has got two. A&M has got two. University of Massachusetts has two. Princeton has one, Purdue has three. You know, you just go from department to department and you find there's hardly a department. UMass has one, okay. There's hardly a department in the United States that really doesn't have at least one on its faculty. See, I've had 60, and I would guess that Harris has probably had 45 PhDs, maybe 40, and certainly Scriven is in that general region now. So that Arnie Fredrickson has had probably 25, you know, so that you could easily name 200 without any difficulty, half of whom are probably in academic jobs around the country. So there are a lot of.
Let me ask one last question.
Okay.
Unless there's any other area you want to touch on that I haven't. What are the positive and negative changes you've seen in the profession in your career?
I suppose we'll speak about students first. We talked about that before. I would say that there was a time, certainly up until maybe 8 years ago, when chemical engineering got some of the very best students. Undergraduates got some of the very best students. I mean, and I would say in the years, for example, from 58 through 72 or 73, there were some superb graduate students came out, and not only Minnesota but all over. I mean, they got very, very good students. Also at that time, I think chemical engineering was held in very high regard by a lot of people. Okay. Now, I spent roughly 3.5 years from January of 1984 until almost 1988 in Washington, at least once a month and sometimes every week on end. Okay? And now the situation has changed. My general view at the moment is that chemical engineering is not held in high regard by anybody anymore. It's really kind of considered to be kind of an old conservative bunch of old fogey types who don't want to change anything. That's my perception. See, now there'll be a lot of people who would argue about that, but that's what I see. Okay. Chemical engineers have become very hidebound, and one of the things I said in 1985 was that if we're not careful, we are going to disappear like metallurgy disappeared. Okay, we're going to disappear the same way. Okay, there's still going to be somebody doing chemical engineering, but it's not going to be very exciting stuff. Okay, chemical engineers were always very, very happy to prepare students for the general chemical industry. Okay, DuPont, Monsanto, Allied, you name it. Okay, and they did a hell of a job at that. If you look, for example, at those operations, those huge complex units, you know, we did that. Okay, I mean, I know that chemists, for example, got the idea of, you know, what you can do with what, but chemical engineers are the ones who put that damn thing together, so that the chemical industry is one of the few industries that shows a positive balance of payments. Okay, now that's something we can be very, very proud of. Okay, but the general view I have, and the view that's in the report, is that's going to be short-lived. See, that everybody, the Saudis, the Mexicans, and everybody are going to be able to make all those fancy products with our expertise. We are going to help them do it, as a matter of fact. Okay? And that is going to really raise hell, because they don't have to pay anything for the raw materials. I mean, our chap here says that Saudi oil costs Saudis about 15 cents a barrel to get out of the ground. Okay? So that we have to change, I think. And if you look at our report, it says that we have to get into high-tech areas. We have to get into materials, high-performance materials. We have to get in all kinds of things where the Saudis and the Mexicans and the Taiwanese and the Iraqis and everybody else is not going to be competing with us. Otherwise, we're not going to survive. See? Now, the difficulty is you can't convince academic chemical engineering departments that that's what they ought to do. It's not working, see? It's very depressing, as a matter of fact. The way you find out is you write, for example, to Berkeley and Minnesota and Wisconsin and so on, and say, do you have some young faculty, see? And there's nobody who's really working in polymers. No one's working in composites. Nobody's working in high-performance materials. Now, and I say there's nobody. What I mean is there are very, very few, okay? And that's the business of the future that we have to get into. And I worry about that. My general view also is that the whole chemical engineering profession is in kind of hard times. The number of students are small. When numbers fall off, quality falls off much more. Okay, you don't get this same distribution. You get a much bigger distribution down at the bottom. If you look at what has happened with all these takeovers, when Chevron takes over a Gulf, a lot of research gets stopped. Like, okay, when the Germans take over a chemical company here, that research all disappears. It all it's all being done in Germany. See? So that my general view is that I think that our profession has to wake up. See? I don't know what you think about it or not, but I think we have to wake up. I think we're in for some hard times. See, now, for example, chemical profits are high. At least they were high this last year. See, now, most people, I think that's not going to last. See? And I've never in all my consulting with Exxon and Phillips, Shell, have been impressed with the general quality of engineering research in those outfits. It's never impressed me at all. I always had the feeling that they were, from the standpoint of engineering science, that they were many, many years out of date. I've always had that feeling. Very discouraging, as a matter of fact. Maybe it's always been that way, but I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think so.
Well, I don't want to close on a negative note, but I will say that I really enjoyed this, and I want to thank you for taking the time to spend the afternoon with me.
That's no problem. In this whole effort, I've had a really good time. I mean, I don't regret anything that happened at all, for example, because, you know, as I said before, I always thought I was extremely lucky. I've had the kind of career which most people can't even think about having. Seems to me it was all a big accident, as a matter of fact.
No, I think there are others in print who have said it's more than that.
Well, now I have a hard time figuring out what I should do, as a matter of fact, and I think about that almost every day, as a matter of fact. And if I could figure out, you know, some way I could spend my time, I'd probably retire at the end of the year. But I can't figure out anything I really want to do. And I know my wife doesn't want me hanging around the house. And I don't want to hang around the house because I know what happens.
Are you still teaching here?
Oh, yeah, I teach. I taught this morning from 8 till 10. I lecture Mondays and Wednesdays from 8 to 10. I have one doctoral student who'll be finishing. But then I serve on lots of committees. I serve on search committees, and I'm on the University Senate. And I get involved in lots of activities here on the promotion and tenure committee, and so it's a...
That must, being on a promotion and tenure committee, considering what you were able to do back in the early days at Minnesota.
Well, it's really one of those things that can only make you unhappy. You know, it's not one of those things that makes you happy, because, the fundamental decision you have to make every time you consider a promotion and tenure is, if you let this chap go, can you get somebody better? See, and that ought to be what determines it, you know. But it's not what determines it.
It's the other side of the coin.
Yeah, that's right. See, here I started, for example, before I came here in the fall of 77, promotion and tenure was done by each dean on his own. And I convinced the then chancellor that there should be a university promotion and tenure committee, and I served on that the first year they had it for the whole university. But see, this is a very primitive place. I mean, it's very, very primitive. It's nice, you know, from a certain standpoint, because it's not bound by a lot of rules, regulations, and traditions of various kinds. So here you can do a lot of things that you couldn't think of doing at the University of Minnesota. I always say that the University of Minnesota has a rule and a regulation and a forum and a committee for every possible contingency. And if they don't have one, they're perfectly right to make another one.
Is that one of the reasons you were attracted here at that time, that you felt?
No, what I thought was the following, is that I'd thought some things. What I thought, you see, what went through my mind in 74, 75, 76 is with energy problems. I thought the northern universities were going to have an extremely severe problem because the legislature in Minnesota, I think, became unfriendly to the university. That's what I thought, okay? That's what I thought. And I thought that northern universities were going to have a hard time. I also thought that there were two universities in the South that had lots of potential. One was the University of Florida at Gainesville, and the other one was here. I looked at the University of Houston, and I said, look, here's a city that's probably very shortly going to have 4 or 5 or 6 million people in it, and it ought to have a first-class university. Okay? And I thought about the same thing about the University of Florida. What I didn't understand about here was that the U of H is always going to be number three after the other two. That I hadn't considered, and that was a fundamental error in my thinking. Because those two places do everything they possibly can to hold us back. They work very hard at it. A&M would give half of its own campus away if it could establish something within the city. And 2 years ago, A&M made a power play to take us over. Okay? Could only happen in Texas, you see. And they had some supporters on our regents, as a matter of fact, you see. But when the regents found out that A&M wasn't going to give us anything out of the permanent university fund, they lost interest. Okay. But there was here in 87 and 88, A&M made a big power play. Now I think it's going to be harder for this university really to develop because it really doesn't have any kind of base of support from the city. And the city's having its own financial problems, so therefore the idea of our getting something from the city is kind of remote. In Harris County, in the legislature is a divided group, so that if we could actually get the Harris County delegation all to pull in the same direction, we could get a lot more, but they don't do that. The other thing that's happened here, which has been discouraging, is that the whole central administration here, ever since I have been here, has been extremely unstable. We've had presidents since I've been here now. We've had four presidents, okay? We've had four academic vice presidents. We've had three vice presidents for finance since I've been here. So it's been a very unstable operation. And there's been a little chicanery also, which has kind of upset things. But now we have a lady that showed up on September 1st. She's a black lady who showed up, Marguerite Ross Barnett. And she makes sounds as if she's going to stir things up. We're hoping and waiting. She's only been here for 6 weeks. So we'll see what happens. Yeah, it's been a lot.
I'm a nonstop talker. Oh, I enjoyed it. I think it's, I'm looking forward to seeing the transcript of this. Yeah. Thank you again very much for spending the time.
I've got some stuff I'll send you. A few things I'll send you that will tell you a few things, I think.
All right, I appreciate that.
One I could give you now if you wanted to.